You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Okay, welcome back to the Backcountry Rookies Podcast. I'm your host, Chad Riker. And before we get the show started, I wanted to say thank you to Amy Fletcher. Amy is a photographer who wants to start doing some wildlife photography and video to film her husband, who's Gus, one of the Backcountry Rookies team members, Gus Fletcher. And we tried to get Amy on the show to record as a guest host. Unfortunately, the audio didn't work out when we tried to do that. There was too much bleed over and feedback in the audio, and I spent a lot of time trying to get it all cleaned up in the post edit. And just could never get it right. So I re-recorded the show with Good Bull Outdoors, and they were kind enough to come on and redo the show. And I used Amy's questions in order to do the interview with Good Bull Outdoors. So hopefully Amy got those questions answered, and hopefully everything is good. I can't wait to see what Amy's got going on here in the near future, and she's going to be going with us on the bear hunt in May. Hopefully she learned something. We get some great pictures. She already takes great pictures as it is, but we'll see with the wildlife photography. Jump over to Instagram and check out her page, which is Fletchers and Fawns, at Fletchers and Fawns. Or on Facebook, she's Amy Fletcher Photography. Check out what she's got going on. And like I said, I apologize to her, and I really appreciate Good Bull Outdoors coming back on and agreeing to come on and spend some more time with me to redo the interview so that we could get a good quality show. Okay, now a quick word from our show sponsors, and then we'll get on to the podcast with Good Bull Outdoors. The first sponsor I'd like to thank is Elk 101's University of Elk Hunting. If you're looking for a one-stop shop for elk hunting resources and what you need to get out into the elk woods, University of Elk Hunting is that one-stop shop. University of Elk Hunting has detailed information on everything elk hunting, from choosing your elk calls to packing an elk out of the woods, and every very valuable detail in between. Whether you're a rookie or an experienced hunter, you will learn something from this course. Use the code ROOKIES and save $20 off the University of Elk Hunting. If you're looking for more information about University of Elk Hunting, check out podcast number 4, where Corey Jacobson gives us a good rundown of the program. The second sponsor I want to thank is Go Hunt. When you purchase the Insider program, you get a program that provides you with very accurate draw odds, and you also have access to Go Hunt strategy articles that help you identify the perfect unit for your hunt. Go Hunt has become my go-to resource for choosing units to hunt in. Their filtering system allows you to sort out exactly what you're looking for in a hunting unit. Use the code ROOKIES when you purchase the Insider program and get a $50 in-store credit to be used in the Go Hunt store. If you want more information on Go Hunt, jump way back to episode number 6 with Brady Miller, where we dive deep into Go Hunt and how it can help you be successful. The third sponsor I'd like to thank is Onyx Hunt. Onyx gives you the resources you need to e-scout maps in every state by sorting them out by game management units, and then you can add additional layers to identify the areas you want to hunt most. By downloading your maps ahead of time, this allows you to see all of your maps, the layers, and any added waypoints while you're in airplane mode or on a network. This allows you to easily navigate your hunting areas. Use the code ROOKIES and save 20% off your membership today. Also, listen to podcast number 35 with Dylan Dowson, where we discuss the functions of Onyx and how to use the app. Now let's get to the show. All right, like I said, so today we've got Lauren and Allie from Good Bull Outdoors Photography, and we're just going to jump right into it and let them introduce themselves, and then we'll pick away at some of these questions. We got some really good questions that's going to lead to some really, really good information for you guys. So I want to get right to it. So with that, Lauren, I'll let you introduce yourself. And then Allie, you can follow up and introduce yourself if that works.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'm Lauren with Good Bull Outdoors. And I guess just kind of a quick background. I've been doing photography well since into the film days, back before digital was a thing. And we've really only started Good Bull recently, and it kind of started as, you know, a joint passion between the two of us, and we started doing photography, and that went really well. So we started adding videography, and it's been a pretty cool journey with Good Ball Outdoors.
Hi guys, I am Allie. I am the other half / pack mule of Good Ball Outdoors. I am kind of a rookie videographer and a intermediate hunter. I've been hunting in Texas ever since I was 12, hunted whitetails. Came out here to Colorado and met Lauren and started really falling in love with hunting elk and all aspects of Western, you know, big game hunting. And then he kind of got me into photography, and I've fallen in love with that even more ever since.
So you fell in love more with photography than you did with Lauren, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, his pictures are that good. I mean, he's got the magic sauce.
He's got the hashtag magic sauce. Good for him. Yeah. So, okay. So that's kind of where it all started, was in Colorado. And what year was that?
It was just 2 years ago now. Just over 2 years ago, we started Good Bull Outdoors. Like I said, we've been doing we're both lifelong hunters. Allie's been more Texas whitetail, and I've really been more Western big game. My dad was in the Air Force growing up, so I'm kind of a military brat, and we've been all over the place. But Montana's considered home. I was actually born in Washington, but I've spent more time in Montana than anywhere else, so I feel like Montana's my home. But here we are in Colorado making the best of it and dealing with the with the biggest elk herd in the state, and trying our level best to figure about enough to put a few backstraps on the grill.
Yeah, I was gonna save this till the end, but it seems like a perfect time to ask it. Is it hard to put down the camera and pick up the bow or the rifle or vice versa for you guys? Or do you just feel like, you know, you get a balance of time to do both hunt and photography?
I feel like there's never enough time to do either, let alone do both.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a constant struggle, and back and forth. I think that'll kind of also lead into some of the really unique sets of gear that Lauren has to kind of incorporate the ability to do both in one scenario.
Yeah, I think to jump in there, I'll say that, you know, there are situations where I feel like, you know, we just simply couldn't get enough pictures and video of certain bulls or certain situations. I feel like it would have been great to have a few more days. But I'll tell you that if I've got an opportunity to have that bow in my hand, and if I've got a bow and a camera, and it comes down to whether or not I get the shot on video, the bull's going down. if the video doesn't capture it, that's just going to be too bad. Yeah, it's definitely tough trying to figure out, you know, which one we're going to do. We've definitely sacrificed hunting time for the sake of photography, and we've sacrificed photography for the sake of hunting.
You can definitely take pictures of the back straps later on, right? When they're on the grill or something like that.
I was going to make a kind of offhanded joke, and I'm a vet anyway, so I could stitch them back up all together, and, you know, we can do a nice harvest shot if we needed to.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Find somebody else's bull out there running around, take pictures of that one too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So here we're kind of talking about hunting a little bit. So I have a couple of questions, hunting questions that are related. I think I'll just stick with those real quick, and then we'll jump into the photography stuff here shortly. When you guys hunt, do you guys try to draw tags at the same time, or does one of you try to draw a tag so that the other one can film and photograph that hunt? Or do you guys just put in for tags and you know, luck of the draw?
You know, I think we kind of have different strategies because we're at different points and different places and building points. We're mostly focused right now on over the counter. We're both kind of building points in most of the areas, but you know, we try to get back to Montana and hunt that about every other year. So we'll get tags for the family up in Montana every other year, and then just kind of focus on over the counter here in Colorado. But we're also looking to, you know, possibly get down to Texas and do some, you know, whitetail and hog hunting down there. Allie keeps threatening to bring me down to Texas and you know, get a nice turkey in the blue bonnets, and you know, that'd be kind of a cool picture for us as well. So it changes year by year. We just kind of figure out how much time we have, how much vacation time we have built up, and what we can try to accomplish in that amount of time.
Yeah, come on down to Texas. Right now it's perfect. Turkeys.
How are the blue bonnets?
Ah, they're beautiful. You know they are. So, my brother-in-law just sent me a picture of a huge patch of them out toward West Texas that was just amazing. Looked really cool. Yeah, and the turkeys are out running around like crazy, so it's about time.
Yeah,
I know what I'm talking about. They're there. It happens.
They are there. Okay, well let's move into photography a little bit. We'll come back to hunting, but I got some things I want to hit on a little bit later. So I wanted to ask Lauren, was it Colorado that got you into photography, or were you did you get into photography because of Colorado?
Neither. It was Montana that got me into photography.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's just some absolutely gorgeous places up in Montana. My dad had an old Canon AE-1 film camera laying around, and I used to steal that from him and take it out and, you know, burn through a roll of film and, you know, try to capture some wildlife. And it was never great. You know, I'd occasionally, you know, in a roll of film, I'd get one or two really good shots. And the more I started playing around with it, the better I got with camera. I got, you know, better at framing the pictures and getting close to the game. And it's a different experience when you've got a camera with you rather than your big game hunting. You can sit behind a spotting scope from 100 yards away or 200 yards away and get this great view of them, and you can watch them, and that's great. But to sneak into bow hunting range, which at the time when I started photography, I wasn't even bow hunting yet. I took up bow hunting at 18. So, you know, here I was with the camera and I was basically learning what I needed to know for bow hunting, but using a camera instead. So Montana really got me into photography, and it was film days. It was eventually when I got good enough, I started doing slides and thinking about submitting slides into some of the national magazines. I'd also been writing some articles for some magazines and hadn't really gotten anything published yet, but I did manage to get some very interesting responses back from editors. So, you know, growing up, my dad always had this idolation with Jack O'Connor from Outdoor Life. And I grew up kind of reading the stories that he had. So I had both this appreciation for the writing as well as the photography. And we always made it down to Yellowstone every year as well. So obviously the amount of game in Yellowstone was a really compelling experience, and you couldn't hunt them, so you might as well take pictures of them.
Great place to get into photography. So much to see and do out there.
Yeah, there definitely is. It's Montana is basically, you know, Colorado on steroids. It's, yeah, imagine a place, you know, 50% larger than Colorado with one-fifth of the population.
So do you guys prefer, I guess you kind of answered this already. Let me ask Allie, do you prefer to shoot locally there in Colorado, or do you like to travel when you shoot?
I very much enjoy, you know, doing a lot of the majority of the shooting in Colorado, just because we're so close to Rocky Mountain National Park. That's probably my most favorite place to not only be, but also experience the rut and get some amazing shots. I feel like we can go up there, you know, several times a week and get something completely different and have an incredibly unique experience every single time, even if it's the same bull that we're, you know, we've been tracking for a couple of years now. You know, they always give us something, you know, really memorable. And but, you know, any chance we get, I love to be in Montana as well. So if I could teleport quickly from here and there, I would definitely, you know, be bouncing back and forth between here and Montana.
If you could travel, and this is for both of you guys, and Lauren, I'll ask you first. If you could travel to one place to shoot photography, doesn't need to be wildlife, doesn't have to be, just one place that you would go, where would you go to shoot photography?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, obviously there's some great places in Montana, but since I've already been there, I'm going to say Alaska, from Kodiak brown bears to, you know, some of the, you know, those gigantic Alaska Yukon moose to, you know, to Dall and stone sheep, you know, mountain goats that are pretty accessible. Obviously we've got the mountain goats that hop along Mount Evans up here. You know, some of the mountains up there just make for a much more dramatic backdrop. And I think there's a number of species up there and a number of situations that I would definitely count on my bucket list for photography. And as far as this whole, you know, not taking wildlife photos, I don't know what you're talking about.
It's not a thing, huh? It's wildlife or nothing.
Yeah. I mean, if I want flowers, I can go down to the flower store.
Yeah. Well said. I think it'd be beautiful to go up there and see caribou too. That's an animal I've always wanted to see. I just think those things are cool looking.
Those suckers are number one on my bucket list for hunting. If I get an opportunity to do a guided hunt somewhere, caribou is going to be very, very high on my list.
Yeah, I agree. So Allie, you got lucky. You got to think about that question for a minute. Where would you go to shoot if you had the opportunity?
Lucky/unlucky because he stole my spot, but
well, you can have the same spot, maybe just different reasons for going. How about that?
Well, actually I'll do my probably there. It's probably a tie between Alaska and Africa, like the Maasai Mara area would be a beautiful, beautiful place, not only hunt, but to shoot some really incredible, you know, animals that we only really see in the zoo here.
Yeah.
And we don't have, you know, close by in Montana to see different species of them as well. So I would love to be able to get some good opportunity with some hippos and some giraffes and obviously the lions, but you know, lions are pretty social, so a lot of people can get those. So yeah. It's the more unique you know, animals that you don't really see a lot of footage on, or even correct footage on, to be exact, is what I'd really like to get some interactions with.
Either one of those would be great choices. Tell me a good story that's about a first timer, maybe a mistake that you made, or just one of your favorite first timer photography moments that you had. And Allie, I'm going to address this to you because I know the first time that we recorded this with Amy, you had a pretty exceptional answer to this. So I'll let you go first, and then Lauren, we'll see if you can top her story when she's done.
I can't.
Well, we'll give you a go, and we'll see if you can do it or not. So, Allie, let's hear about that rookie photography story that you have.
Yeah, so the rookie photography story for me would be from this past year, so 2018's elk rut here in Colorado. Lauren and I had our over-the-counter tag for our unit. We went back up to our unit for the weekend to do a weekend hunt, pulled up to our campsite, and all of our camping equipment, including our tent, cots, everything had been stolen. So we were pretty, you know, frustrated and not happy campers, no pun intended, and we decided, you know what, this is kind of ruining our, you know, our juju for elk hunting. So we jumped in the truck and drove straight to Estes, Rocky Mountain National Park, west side, to, you know, try to get over to Estes and spend the night there, and woke up in the morning with a bunch of beautiful velvet bulls, you know, right at our car door, and kind of drove up Trail Ridge Road to head over into Estes so we could get some coffee. And we noticed that right over Trail Ridge Road was one of the many wildfires that had been going on throughout the summer. And that there was a helicopter, you know, flying back and forth from an actual little pond, or what is it? It was a lake. Yeah. A lake or pond?
Lake.
Okay. A lake to get water to actually try to, you know, put the fire out. And after our third time back and forth, coming from Estes to the west side of the park, I look over and I scream to Lauren to stop the truck because there's an elk, you know, sitting there just watching everything happen. And I was like, oh my gosh, is that an elk? And you need to stop and look. So he stops and pulls over and starts to try to take a couple pictures, you know, through the window. And he's like, you know what, we need to actually like get on this. I'm going to go drive down, you know, a little ways and just get out of the car and we'll just walk down there and see how close we can get to, you know, get some really good footage. Cause I mean, the elk was bedded down and just, you know, enjoying the scenery and nice. I'm sure he was getting some nice water splashes.
Not to interrupt her, but she was being kind to me. I actually stopped in the middle of the road and backed up traffic to get a couple of photos.
Yeah, that's true. So we had just, fortunately, we had just purchased what we now have as our video camera. And it was actually my first ever time having it in my hand, actually shooting anything. And one of the things that I definitely took from that opportunity was not having a tripod was very detrimental to some of the footage that we got. I actually ended up having to, you know, Lauren has several pictures of me getting footage and I'm just in these awkward you know, positions half on a rock, half not, because I'm trying to get really good footage of not only, you know, the helicopter flying up to drop, to make the drop, but, you know, the elk's reaction kind of in the foreground at the same time. So there's a lot of Blair Witch Project looking, you know, footage going on, but it was probably one of the most amazing opportunities, but the probably the biggest learning lesson I've had so far as, you know, making sure that we always have a, tripod pretty handy, because you never know how long you're going to be sitting in a certain situation. And the more hand-holding and zoom in you do, the shakier it's going to get. And so that's definitely my story for that. It was really, really cool.
I think it's hard to say you got any lessons learned when you see something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of work with what you got and capture that moment. Do you guys ever, I'm sorry, Lauren, give me one second. I got a question here. Do you guys ever carry a monopod because they're so lightweight and you can just kind of use them like a trekking pole or whatever if you need to?
So I actually, if I'm going to be doing videography for a hunt, I actually prefer to have a monopod. And a big reason for it is that, like you said, it's very transportable. It's also obviously quieter than a tripod. It's not as sturdy, of course, but with the optical image stabilization that we've got on the camera, it's more than enough. But one of the really cool things is that when you screw it into the bottom of the video camera, it almost acts as a gimbal with a weight hanging down below. So it actually helps you as you're hand holding and you're walking. It actually helps stabilize the video even more than just the optical image stabilization itself.
Huh. Kind of like a stabilizer on a bow, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Helps balance it a little bit. Okay. Well, you get your opportunity to top that story. What do you got?
I don't have anything anywhere near that that good. I think just from a photography standpoint, when I got the new digital equipment, you know, there have been several times when I was getting acclimated to the new digital equipment that I simply didn't know the equipment as well as I should have going out there. And I had bought a book for it and I had, you know, obviously thumbed through the book. But it really just takes an exposure to the camera and the equipment and using it regularly in order to really get comfortable knowing everything that you need to know about the camera and its settings. And we had an opportunity where we were up in Rocky Mountain National Park in July a couple of years ago when I had, you know, this relatively new camera. I've got a Canon 5D Mark III, and I had set the ISO setting, which is a level that photographers are going to be familiar with, and it's basically a setting that says how much light is required in order to expose the quote unquote film, because ISO was determined back in the film days, but it basically says there's this trade-off between whether or not you want to take a picture fast and have the picture turn out grainy, or whether or not you want the picture to be slower, but turn out really crisp and clear. And in this particular case, I'd been shooting previously in some darker conditions, and I turned that ISO up to where I could try to get an image that was, you know, fast enough that the animals weren't all blurred out. Well, when we got out with this 400-inch bull, that was, you know, velvet-covered bull in the middle of July, you know, hanging up by this mountain lake, lo and behold, I had my ISO turned up really high. So even though it was sunny out, all of my pictures turned out super grainy because of that high ISO. So you know, unfortunately, it ruined basically an entire day's worth of photos. I managed to get a couple that I could kind of clean up a little bit for Instagram, but it was never anything that I could that I would be comfortable printing off and giving to a client as an actual, you know, canvas or paper print or something like that.
Yeah, that's hard to do. Is when you burn up a day like that and then look back on it, and especially when you have a bull like that, that would be tough.
So we were fortunate. We were able to go back up and another day, and we managed to keep track of that bull for quite a while, right up until just before the rut really hit its peak, and he pretty much stayed in the same area. He kind of disappeared shortly after he shed the velvet, but we were able to get some other really good photos of him, and then he came back into the same area last year. So we're hoping to make it 3 years in a row now on that bull and getting some great photos and videos.
When you go out shooting, like, how often do you guys go out to shoot? And then how many pictures do you take in a day when you, like, how many does it take to get just that one picture, you know, that perfect picture? And I'm sure that number varies, but just out of curiosity, do you have to take 100 pictures? Do you have to take 200 pictures? What is it?
I would say on any given day, it really depends on the light. You have to have to get a, what I call a quote unquote keeper, you have to have one of two different things. And our philosophy differs from a lot of other photographers. A lot of photographers are real purists on the image. They won't post anything unless it's an absolutely stunning image. We actually post a lot of images that I don't consider necessarily high quality images. The criteria for those is, do they tell an interesting story? So we're really big on not just conveying these great pictures of the environment and the animals that we're in. We're also really big on telling the story of the behavior of the animals that are out there and the situations that they get themselves into. So we may have like a really dark, overcast sky that normally we wouldn't even bother to take photos of. But if we see something interesting, it's worth us clicking off a few pictures of it and see if we can capture it. We caught some behavior of this 6-point bull elk being aggressive towards another elk. And the aggression that he showed, we got both some video and some still shots of it. But it showed a response, a vocalization that a lot of people, that we've asked about have never even heard of, let alone seen before. So, situations like those are also what we consider, winners and keepers and things that we're looking out there for. But then the other types of photographs that are just, pristine and beautiful with, great light and that sharp, crisp reflection in the eye and all that. It really just depends on how frequently you put yourself in that situation, whether or not you have, the sun at your back and the animals in front of you. You can get 100 great photos in a day, or you can get one. It really just depends on the situation you're in. And it's more the animals and their behavior as well as the light than it is necessarily the photographer itself.
Can I kind of give you an example or a comparison of what our editing process is like?
Of course.
Okay. You've been to the eye doctor, correct?
Yep.
Okay. So, when they're trying to get the right prescription for you, they ask, okay, one or two?
Yeah.
Two or one?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he has this incredible knack for taking, how many shots do you think, shots of one scenario?
So let's say, for example, I've got a bull doing something in front of me. I will typically crank off a group of five, and then very shortly after that, I'll crank off another group of five to try to catch that behavior. So 10 shots for just that one instant of behavior.
Yeah. So we'll get, we're in looking at the pictures from the day and like, oh my gosh, that's so great. And then when it comes to, trying to figure out if we're going to put that picture up or, what we're going to do with it, when we go into editing it, we're like, okay, is this the best one out of this whole series? And so, but if he didn't do that, then we've kind of realized that we would miss so much. I think that, a lot of photographers, like he was saying, they'll wait for, the perfect atmosphere, to try to capture that moment. And Lauren's really good at just kind of completely being in that moment and just firing off. And that just turns out into all these remarkable footage that we get.
And it is remarkable. When you look through your guys' Instagram portfolio, I guess you would call it, or your Facebook, there's just so many amazing pictures on there. And it's hard to believe you guys have only been doing this for a couple of years and gathering those pictures. So I wanted to move into, I'm sorry, Allie, that was an excellent comparison. Because I can only imagine sitting there at a computer screen and looking at them, and you see the one and you think it's perfect, and then you go to the next one and you're like, oh, that one's even just a touch better.
Yep.
Nope, the third one's just a little bit better.
Yep.
Yeah. So that statement leads kind of perfectly into my next topic, which was equipment. Now, one question that Amy didn't have on here was editing equipment, and I would like to talk a little bit about that. Since we've talked about editing and going to the eye doctor and all that stuff, what do you guys use to do that? How do you guys edit your photographs, and what do you use? What do you blow them up on? How do you look at them?
So we import everything into, we have kind of a bank of external hard drives that we store all of our photos on right now. And I want to say right now, we just bought 16 terabytes worth of hard drive space. So that brought us up to, I think, around 24 terabytes of hard drive space in total. So it gives you an idea of the quantity of data that we have between photo and video. And of course, that's enough expansion for probably another year to 2 years. I'm hoping it lasts that long. So we went ahead and we download everything onto those, and then we've got them backed. We have backup hard drives as well. And then we'll start looking through them just through a video viewer, Windows, et cetera. And we'll start finding the ones that we want, and we'll go ahead and change the name on those so that they're quicker to find and import. And then we import all the ones that we think are really good into Lightroom. And then within Lightroom, we kind of blow them up and take a look at them and decide, which ones we want to do for which situations.
Adobe Lightroom.
Yeah, Adobe Lightroom.
Okay.
For those that don't know. And there's, for those that are just getting into it, there's a photography package where for $10 a month, you can get both Lightroom and Photoshop. And we use Lightroom for editing 98% of the time. It's really only if we want to do some promotional things with the photos, like if we want to put words, text on it, or if we want to put, if we want to merge multiple photos together, which we almost never do except for advertising. It's kind of one of these things among photographers, that the purists among the group, that if you're ever going to do a multiple image shot, that you very clearly label that as a multi-image shot. There's a lot of people who do compositions that are multiple images that capture a scene that seems unrealistic. And just for an ethical standpoint, most photographers, if they've done something like that during an edit, they will specifically state what they've done to the photo to make it look the way it looks if it wasn't captured naturally. So we do, if it's a good photo, there's not a lot that we have to do. We tend to dehaze a photo a little bit. We tend to up the vibrance just a little bit, and then typically play with the exposure a little bit. Some areas of the photo, the shadow may be darker than we want it to, so we may lighten shadows, or we may deepen the blacks a little bit if the image was a little bit overexposed in the camera. I always shoot in something called aperture priority mode, which means that when I adjust the camera, the ISO is set and I have the aperture set at a given rate, and then I let the speed of the camera vary up and down based on the amount of light in the situation. So if I'm shooting wildlife, I'm typically shooting at an f5.6, and let's just say ISO 400. That tells the camera how much to set the speed for to allow enough light in to properly expose the photo. And sometimes the camera's good at it and it exposes it right, but sometimes you're a little high, a little low, whatever the case may be. And you can tweak that if you're shooting in raw images compared to shooting in JPEG. That's a very important point for photographers. Always shoot in raw because it captures more data. So when you're doing your post edit, if you need to adjust the exposure, let's say your exposure was off a full step, you can do that in Lightroom and you'll have enough data saved in the raw. Whereas in the JPEG, you're probably only going to get about a quarter to a half of a step of light before your image is degraded. So okay. Lightroom for doing that kind of editing, Photoshop for adding any text to it. And then if we switch over to video, we're now using Adobe Premiere Pro.
Okay. Yeah. Good. So you talked about ISO earlier. You kind of defined that. Talk just briefly about what f-stop is. And like you mentioned f5.6, just quick definition on what f-stop is.
Absolutely. So f-stop is basically a definition of how wide the iris inside of the lens opens up. So if you think about your own eye, if you're in a really bright situation, your eye is going to constrict down really small to decrease the amount of light that's coming in. And the f-stop on a camera lens does exactly the same thing. When you decrease that f-stop down to, let's say, 5.6, it actually narrows your focal distance, which means that the depth of field that is going to be in focus. So if you have an object that's relatively close, like let's say an animal, an elk, and you're focused in on their eye and you're shooting down at f5.6, probably most of the head is going to be in focus, but the far side of the antlers are going to be out of focus. And that's going to change as they get further away, that focal depth is going to get bigger. But let's say now, for example, instead of shooting at f5.6, you bump it up to f11, that antler that was out of focus is now going to be in focus. But that exposure, that f-stop, means that you're going to have to expose the image for a longer period of time in order to fully expose the image. So basically what you've done is by going from f5 to f11, you've actually caused that iris to constrict and close. And the further closed that that iris is, the bigger the depth of field, but also the slower the image ends up taking. And I know one thing that I touched about previously that folks probably need to hear is, you know, well, how fast an image do I need to take? And I'll tell you, for an animal that's perfectly still, you can probably get away with as slow as 1/60th. A lot of people will tell you that's the minimum speed necessary for hand holding a photo and getting a good image. But really, when you're looking at photographing wildlife, the absolute slowest you really want to go is about 1/250th of a second. And I'd really say for really crisp, sharp images on a moving animal, 1/500th. If you're talking birds, you're talking closer to, 1/1000th or 1/2000th. So if you've got a duck flying, or if you've got a bird taking off, and with those really fast wing beaks, you're going to be looking at closer to 1/2000th of a second. So you need a lot of light to do that.
Got it. In my research that I've done looking for cameras, that 1/200th, that comes on a pretty high dollar camera, right?
No, 1/200th is actually pretty standard. Most cameras will do anything from about, 1/4 all the way up to about 1/2000th or 1/4000th. And everything in between. That's not really where you're getting the most bang for your buck. What really ends up costing more money is A, the lenses, and B, the sensor in the camera. So if you look at a less expensive camera, a lot of times what you're giving up is the size of the sensor. So if you look at, for example, the size of the sensor on my 5D Mark III, it's going to be a little bit over an inch across. And that's how big the quote unquote film is. So if you can imagine, conversely, a cell phone and the size of the sensor that has, you're looking at like maybe 1/4 inch across on the sensor for the cell phone. So imagine which one's going to be pulling in more light and going to give you more quality and detail. Obviously, the bigger the sensor, the more sensitive that sensor is, the better its low light capability is going to be. And that's really where the 5D Mark III and the professional level full frame sensor cameras earn their money.
Got it. Okay. A lot to take in there. So
yeah, it definitely is.
Yeah. So what is a good camera setup for first-time shooter or a beginning shooter?
So there's a number of manufacturers out there. I would say the main ones for wildlife photography are going to be Canon, Nikon, and Sony. Sony really has a niche with the mirrorless. They've been doing those for a longer period of time, but the mirrorless are more expensive too. So if you're looking at a brand new photographer and you're not really sure if you want to get into this, or you just don't have the money to really expend on this, I would say look at one of two things. I would look at getting a crop sensor camera, or I would look at getting a used mirrorless camera. Mirrorless is kind of the wave of the future, especially with wildlife photography, because you don't have the click of that mirror bouncing up and down every time you take a picture. It can be completely silent, which obviously, if you're not spooking the animals, you're going to get better pictures. But my recommendation for a lot of first-time photographers is, most are trying to keep it to around $1,000 or less. So I would say look at something like the Canon T6i, or maybe the Canon T7i, which is a little bit more money. It doesn't have a ton more features for wildlife photographers. So I usually tell people, save a little bit of money, go with the T6i. It's so pretty, new technology. And the other thing that I mentioned that probably needs to be explained a little bit more is, what is a crop sensor camera versus a full sensor camera? So a crop sensor camera, there's actually what they call a cropping factor. It is a smaller sensor. It's obviously a lot bigger than what you've got in the cell phone. But because it's a smaller sensor, it actually creates a higher zoom rate for the lens. So when we say, I'll just use my biggest lens with my Sigma 150 to 600 millimeter. 600 millimeter is about the equivalent of a 20 power binocular. So if we take that 20 power at 600 millimeter, if you had a crop sensor that had a 1.5 crop on it, that 600 millimeter lens now acts as a 900 millimeter lens, the 1.5 times the 600. So if you're looking at saving money on wildlife photography, one of the things that a crop sensor camera does for you is that it gives you a higher zoom capability for the same amount of lens that you end up buying. So if you buy Very common with a T6i is a kit lens that's a 100 to 300 millimeter zoom. So that 100 is actually 150 millimeters, and that 300 is actually 450 millimeters. So it's almost like buying a more powerful lens than what you can get on a full frame camera. One of the bad things is that when you go to upgrade to a full frame because of the benefits of that bigger sensor, you can't take the lens with you. That's actually changing with the Canon mirrorless. They're actually creating adapters that allow you to use both sets of lenses. But as it stands right now, if you just went from, a current level, let's say a T6i, and you wanted to upgrade to the lower end of the full frame cameras, the Canon 6D Mark II, you were not going to be able to use those lenses from the one camera to the next.
Do you lose image quality between the crop sensor and the full frame sensor?
You lose a little bit. Really, what you lose is that low light capability. It just can pick up more, but you can take absolutely professional level, super crisp images, especially if you get one of the Canon L series lenses. And the reason that I'm talking about Canon so much is really that, it's what I know, it's what I've been shooting with for a long time. We know a number of folks that shoot Nikon as well and are super happy with it. And we know a few people who also use Minolta and Sony and are really happy with those as well. So it's not so much the manufacturer, it's what you're comfortable with. But obviously Nikon and Sony are the two biggest names in camera. So those are the ones that that get the most attention, and we're the most familiar with Canon.
So how about lenses then for that T6i, T7i level camera? What lenses would you recommend that a person takes with them?
So I'll preface that by saying that there's two different kinds of wildlife photographers. There's the kind of wildlife photographers who are in it purely for the wildlife, and they're not necessarily your audience, which are, hunting enthusiasts who, also may be interested in promoting and doing things on Instagram, related to building a business like we do. We do both the wildlife photography and videography as well as commercial photography. And the two uses are really quite separate. With the videography specifically for wildlife and the photography for wildlife, you're really looking at zoom factor. How close can I get to that animal? A big part of it is that, let's say, for example, it's August and you've got a rutting bison that you're trying to get a picture of. You don't want to get, you don't want to get 20 feet away from that bull. He's going to stomp you into the ground. So obviously having a good camera lens is going to, keep you safe, but also give you some great photos as well. And for the individual who is who's doing that, getting the largest telephoto lens that you can is going to be important. Tamron, Sigma, there's a few out there that make a really solid 150 millimeter to 600 millimeter lens, and that's probably going to be your best bet if you can spend that kind of money. But you're looking at doubling the cost of the camera body if you do that. If you're really looking at just getting an intro piece, I would, for most photographers, look at getting a kit lens that has has these two lenses on it. One is going to be a wide angle lens, something like an 18 to 55. And then the other one is going to be like a 75 to 300 millimeter. That's going to allow you to do, with that 75 to 300, you're going to be able to handle pretty much all of your wildlife photography. Because again, with the crop factor, you're really talking about going up to about 450 millimeters, which is enough to do some decent photography with wildlife. It's a little bit undergun for some of the long distance photography, but you can zoom in a bit with the high megapixel sensors that these cameras have. But then for your product photography, for taking pictures of people that are out there, if you want to, film parts of a hunt that are, showing off an individual and what they're doing, or, showing, filming shed hunting and that sort of thing. If you're into that, it's kind of that season. That wide angle is going to be better for doing those types of photos. You need to be able to get close to people and show a wide scene. And that 18 to 55 is going to give you that wide angle that you need for doing those close-ups on products, on camo, on people, et cetera. So that those two different kit lenses will really, really give you the widest possible uses without costing you a ton of money.
Gotcha. Now, I also hear a lot about the Nifty 50. What is so special about the 50 millimeter lens? Or is there anything special about it?
There is. So a 50 millimeter is something that's called a prime lens. Prime lens have certain characteristics. And for the 50 millimeter, it's probably considered like the prime, or like you say, the nifty 50. It's what most clearly represents the human eye. So when you're taking a picture, if you're doing portrait photography, for example, a 50 millimeter will more closely represent what the human eye sees. If you go wider than that, you start getting distortion. And if you get bigger than that, so by wider, I mean a smaller millimeter number. So let's say, for example, an 18 millimeter is going to be much wider. If you get down to 16 millimeter, it's actually such a big distortion that it's called a fisheye. It actually creates this like globe effect where you're, you know, like you've got a giant fisheye or you're inside of a goldfish bowl where you can see all the way around you, but it creates this distorted effect. And the bigger lenses, like a 600 millimeter, create such a flat image that it creates something called really good bokeh, which is distortion in the background with a crisp, solid, focal plane. Which is a really cool effect, especially for filming. But if you're looking at doing people and product photography, that 50 millimeter gives you a couple things. It's prime, which means it's super crisp and typically has very good glass. It also is a very fast lens, meaning that oftentimes they go down to f1.8, meaning you can get a super narrow depth of field. But you can also take pictures very fast with it. And it has a lot of advantages. Plus, it's not a terribly expensive lens. That 50 millimeter has been around for a long time. And oftentimes you can get a super crisp used 50 millimeter lens for $100 or $200. And it'd be something that if it were, say, a 135 prime, you'd be looking at spending, possibly $700-$900 for it.
Wow. Okay. Cool. Allie, we haven't heard from you in a while.
I'm learning some stuff here.
Well, good. So let's talk to you about video setups then. You've said you've taken on the role as the videographer for the team.
Yes.
What would a beginner want in something to take video?
Well, I would say, especially for wildlife videography, you definitely want something that's going to help, reduce the wind noise and the noise around you. So you want to get a pretty decent external microphone, as well as the wind sock, the wind distorter. And definitely anything that is going to have, a better zoom capability, some of the aspects that Lauren was saying for shooting with the camera, is going to obviously intertwine with videography as well. As I mentioned before, having a nice tripod, a nice heavy tripod, is definitely key to have, especially any of the instances that, we're in where there's one person doing videography and there's another person doing the camera work. Sometimes, it can just be one of us. So having that really sturdy tripod to have a video camera set on while the other, while they're also doing the camera work is pretty key. We unfortunately ran into an issue a couple weeks ago when we were up in the park and we found a really, really great bachelor herd of bulls. Half of them had dropped, half of them were still packing, and this nice big wind gust came in. As soon as we went to go grab the truck, we thought we had the tripod, pretty set and steady with the video camera to keep it rolling because they were just kind of feeding slowly. And we run, go get the truck to move the truck down. As soon as we pull up to the area, a big gust of wind comes and literally picks up the tripod and the video camera and slams it down on its side. Luckily, it was the side that actually had the wind sock protector on it, so it didn't really do that much damage, but we just kind of had it on a pretty thin tall tripod, so we're definitely gonna probably get that back on our Manfrotto, and that has the gimbal head on it for more durability, I think.
Okay, yeah, so that was going to be next, was the tripod. I'm sorry, do you video in 4K or 1080?
Yes, we 4K.
Okay. And so, is that, so this is a debate that I see a lot. do we need 4K yet? Do you need it? Is 1080p enough? What do you guys think about that? Do you need 4K?
I say absolutely.
I'm kind of opinionated on this one. So I started off with this, taking a lot of like 1080. The camera that I have, the 5D Mark III, only does 1080, which it takes some fantastic video. But one of the things that the 4K gives you the ability to do, the reason it's called 4K is it has four times more data than 1080p. And so imagine, if you will, the ability to digitally zoom four times into the photo. You can multiply the optical zoom of the camera by four, and you can still get a 1080p image off of a 4K video by zooming in four times deeper. So with our camera, we have a 20 power optical zoom. But if you can go another four power digital in, now we've got an 80 power zoom off of the same setup.
Yeah.
So by taking 4K video, you're able to zoom in considerably more than you could if you were taking regular 1080p.
Yeah, leave the spotting scope at home, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so I mentioned spotting scope, and you guys talked about it earlier. Do you guys digiscope at all? Do you have like the camera mounts and the stuff to attach it to a spotting scope, or do you just use that big zoom lens that you have?
Right now, we just use the big zoom lens. We're actually kind of between spotting scopes at this point. I had a cheaper, older one that broke on me a while ago, and we haven't replaced it yet. But we are looking to pick up a Burris spotting scope here for this upcoming shed season and bear hunting.
Yeah, we've been fortunate enough to where actually having really good binos have really, really helped us, to where we haven't been in too many situations where it's been like a either have spotting scope or no game. So, but like both y'all said, I feel like the video camera is definitely a good substitute. You're not only having to not utilize something like a phone scope, which is, awesome and a really good piece of technology, but, without having the spotting scope itself, it's kind of a moot point. So I definitely think that having that video camera and actually being able to record, as you're kind of searching and looking around is, even better, even trifolds in the editing department when you go back in and you get to kind of see things that you even missed while you were recording.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to have to look into those. I don't like spotting scopes. I can't look through them very long. I get eye fatigue really bad, and I prefer binos too. So I like a more powerful bino rather than some, 40 power spotting scope.
Yeah,
but if you can put it up on a video camera and you can just sit there and look at the little digital screen, that's even better than both.
Yeah. So I actually have a disease called nystagmus. So where it's quivering of the eye. So looking into, one lens, like a spotting scope, is actually very difficult for me as well. So any spotting scope that, we do use, we have to get the extra attachment for to kind of turn it into a bino viewer. So, it kind of creates problems, with shooting the bow and shooting through a scope for a gun as well, or a rifle as well. So I usually have to patch my eye in order to be able to actually not have my eyes try to jump back and forth to the viewfinder.
Maybe I need to do that. Maybe that'll tighten up my groups a little bit.
Yeah.
Another consideration about the video camera is, the one that we have, if you've seen pictures of it, it's a pretty substantial thing. I mean, it's bigger than a spotting scope is. But keep in mind that you could get something like a Sony Handycam. I think they're about, for a good one, I think they're about $800. And they're going to have, you can find ones that have a 20 power optical zoom on it that'll shoot in 4K. So you could actually set that up instead, and it would be about half to a quarter of the weight of a spotting scope, and you'll be able to use that as your recorder and your zoom lens all in one. And I think that's really a valuable, alternative, especially for folks who are going to be filming their hunt anyway. Some of the smaller ones have extremely good optical image stabilization, that, you know, kind of like how the GoPros do. Obviously, it's not as good when you're zoomed way in, but they have great options for hand holding because the manufacturers know that they're super light. They know that there's going to be shake, so they've worked very hard to try to eliminate that shake as you're hand holding. And then, of course, when you can put it up on a tripod, it becomes very steady.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking of tripod again, what do you guys use?
Well, our best tripod right now is Manfrotto 055X Pro. It's pretty heavy. We're actually looking at purchasing another one. We had, like Allie said, the other one that we had was too light, and we went ahead and that one actually kind of broke as the tripod fell, which is part of the issue. So we went ahead and just recently acquired, it's not yet arrived, but should be here this week, another of these heavier Manfrotto tripods. There's lots of good brands out there. I think the biggest thing is just trying to marry the height of the device with the weight and what's going to be put on top of it. If all you're looking to put on top of it is a very small camcorder or a set of binoculars, then you don't need something significantly heavy. But if you're going to be putting a camera on top of it like mine, which weighs about 14 pounds between the body and the lens, as well as the gimbal head that's going to be sitting on top of it, you have to have a very substantial tripod in order to not shake and wobble as you're taking photo and video with that.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So we beat up gear pretty good, or equipment, I guess. What advice, Allie, I'll ask you first, and then Lauren, I'll jump over to you. What advice do you have? One piece of advice for a beginning photographer?
I would say not to be afraid to kind of get away from the crowd. I know, especially in our line of what we do, you know, we're around a pretty popular national park numerous times a week. So we see, you know, your typical tourists, as well as really, really, really phenomenally talented photographers, you know, out there. And everyone's is out there trying to get, you know, this, their money shot of this money, you know, huge, incredible, and which is awesome and, you know, really cool to do. But at the same time, you get a lot of other interference around you. And if you just kind of utilize your GPS system, or, you know, asking the locals around of, you know, other places, you can use Facebook, you know, social media like Facebook. They have, for Estes anyway, they have an Elk and Estes group. So there's people posting, you know, daily on, you know,
shh, don't tell them that.
Is that part of the magic sauce or the secret sauce right there?
I think I just gave our secret sauce away. I don't know.
That's okay. But I could cut that out. No problem.
It's all good.
I meant Kansas. It's this place in Kansas.
Estes, Kansas.
Yeah. Elk and Estes, Kansas. Right. You can go. I mean, it's obviously a closed group. So, you know, the people check you out, make sure you're a legit elk lover, and you're not going to, you know, come in and really disturb the peace, but they do a really good job at kind of keeping tabs on the local herd and, you know, posting some really great shots. Some, you know, mostly are just little camera phone shots, but I don't think we would have gotten, I would say, half the shots, if not, you know, three-fourths of the shots that we've gotten if it wasn't for kind of stepping away from that main money shot bull for a little bit to get some really, really quiet, intimate, you know, very, very long time, you know, experiences with certain herds, and especially during the rut when, like, the park, you know, per se is super, super crowded and busy and causing, you know, elk jams every 2 seconds. You know, that it's great if you get that one shot, but it's not so great if you have to, you know, elbow, you know, so-and-so in the head and, you know, honk your horn during a video or have, you know, rangers coming up and, you know, making silly jokes and blowing air horns, you know, when you're getting really good video of elk frenzies and whatnot. So we had a really, really awesome opportunity this past rut when we were up there, is after we got some really good shots of the incredible and another bull that I'm absolutely obsessed with. We call him Gunther. We got a little bit of time with him, and Lauren said, you know what, let's just go see what else we can find. And we were stuck in a little elk jam if we would have turned around right away. So he's like, let's just drive up a little ways and, you know, go down to the picnic area and see if we see anything. And I love and absolutely obsessed with calling elk all year round for no matter what we're doing, whether it's in a hunting aspect or for a photography. I love calling and talking to them and having, you know, whatever type of conversation we can have in order to get, you know, some good interactions with them. And I was like, well, if we park, why don't we see if I can just, you know, call a bull in? And there was nothing around. It was literally us in this parking lot and just amazingly quiet around us. So I just, you know, throw out a couple bugles and a couple elk calls, and lo and behold, we get this very faint bugle from, you know, right kind of off the crest of the mountain in front of us. And I just keep calling, and we reeled them right in, and it was us and this, you know, pretty nice satellite bull. He was 6 points, right?
5 by 6.
Oh, 5 by 6. Okay. We're with them for a good hour to hour and a half, and you know, we kept reeling him in, and he knew that there weren't any cows there, but he didn't know at the same time. So it was really, really cool to do that. So to kind of bring it back, just like I said, not being afraid to step away from the crowds and, you know, going on your own little adventure just to find some really, really cool, intimate moments that other people don't have the chance or the know-how to find.
So who's the better caller between you two?
I am.
I'm not gonna argue with her. One of the benefits that what I was gonna say is one of the benefits I have with the situation is that you know, much like you know, somebody like Corey Jacobson would recommend that you know, the hunter goes out in front and the caller stays behind. You know, if you watch his series on YouTube, you know, you'll see that they always set up that way. There's a reason for it. When somebody's calling further back, the person who's up front can get closer to the animals. And I'm really the beneficiary of that by being able to take that camera, you know, 50, 75 yards up ahead of her. She called this bull right up into my lap. And while she was enjoying the view from back where she was at, I was enjoying being very close to this animal that had no clue that I was there. And that's, you know, that's been a huge benefit for us as well. You know, working as a team, she'll call them in for me, and she's really gotten great at learning the interactions and the calls to say and when. And she's been able to hold those bulls and keep them coming back for more. In the meantime, I'm getting some great pictures, and they're kind of ignoring the click, click, click from the side.
Yeah, and he's really, really great with the diaphragm calls, but I have a really small palate, so I haven't mastered the diaphragm calls yet. I use other type of calling, you know, ways, and but you know, you just got to do what works best for you.
Okay, Lauren, what's your one piece of advice for a beginning photographer?
I think my biggest advice for a beginning photographer is just get out there and shoot. The more you're taking pictures, the more you're taking video, the more you're going to understand how the equipment works. And when you get that once in a lifetime opportunity, you'll know how to set your camera up to take advantage of that. I know that, you know, certainly when I have new equipment, one of the first things that I do is go over it again and again and again, but there's nothing that actually takes the place of getting that experience out in the field with it. And knowing that if you don't adjust the ISO, it's going to ruin your day. If you don't know how to, you know, correct the camera for changing conditions, you're going to lose a shot that is, you know, the entire reason that you made the trip up there in the first place. So get out there, shoot as much as you can. Like I said, we shot 55,000 photos last year, and it wasn't too much. It really was not. Yeah, it's a lot to go through. It's a lot to have to store. But we just, you know, we think when we're looking through there about how many images we captured that we wouldn't have had if we wouldn't have just taken the picture. Now, the caveat to that is, the longer you've been doing this, the longer you understand what types of photos you want and which you don't. And I will tell you that I'm done taking pictures of animals with their head stuck down in the grass feeding. There might be an interesting, you know, close up of their antlers that I want to take, but I don't need 20,000 photos of a bull elk with his head stuck down in the grass. I'd much rather have a picture of him up, you know, with his head up, looking alert, looking regally or bugling. Those are all behaviors that I want to see and I want to express a lot more than, you know, the animal hidden down on the ground. And you just see this, you know, body of the animal sticking out, like any, you know, tourist with a, you know, with a 5 cent camera could capture, from their car door.
I have a kind of funny little side story about that. So Lauren is really, really good at having his bucket list, his daily bucket list of what kind of shots he wants for that day. And, you know, we'll be going up when, you know, it's a really, really snowy, yucky day. And be like, you know what? I think today I want to try to find a picture of a bull, you know, with this clear, starry sky and this big moon coming up, you know, behind it. And the skies will literally part and we'll get up there. And all of a sudden, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and 2 hours later, it's nighttime with this beautiful moon. And Lauren has this, you know, shot with the guy sitting on the moon and, you know, fishing from it, basically a DreamWorks shot. And, you know, that he's so crazy. Like it's obviously not that severe, but he really has a good mind of what kind of shots are, you know, would seem really, really cool. And I started kind of a running joke with him saying, all right, so what I would like to get today is this. So I need you to say it out loud so it'll actually happen. And my biggest one was I wanted to finally get some pictures of some bulls in Lake Estes. And I, you know, we'd been up there several times, not only during the summer, but the beginning of rut, and never happened. And so I said, okay, I need you to say it out loud that you want pictures of a bull, you know, in Lake Estes. And he's like, okay, I want a bull in Lake Estes. 25 minutes later, we're driving past the lake and there's these cows, this whole harem is walking into the lake, and lo and behold, this bull's fallen right behind them. So he's really, really lucky and really good.
That's the magic sauce right there.
Yep. He just oozes hashtag magic sauce.
Yeah. And it should be. Yep. Yeah. So good. Yeah. Good, good.
You know, I got to tell you, she actually wrapped up a point that I was trying to make about knowing your camera really well with that story of the bowl of the moon coming up in the background. So it's a lighting situation that's very difficult because it's obviously the sun's already gone down, but the moon is rising up. The moon was a full moon. It was very bright. But the scene itself was not very bright. So you couldn't simply take a picture of the scene and capture everything that you needed to. Most cameras nowadays have something called HDR, which is called high dynamic range. And you have to it actually takes three different pictures at three different exposure levels, one right after the other. And then within the camera, it combines the three and takes the best parts of each one. It's not a setting that is relatively easy to find. And if I hadn't practiced with that setting previously, I actually wouldn't have been able to get that shot, even though that was one that I was going into the day wanting to get. So, you know, she actually wrapped up very nicely what I said. The more you shoot, the more comfortable you are with your equipment, the more likely you are to get that once in a lifetime image. And that was a situation where that exact thing happened. If I didn't know how to get that HDR setting in the camera, it never would have turned out okay.
You have to think too, and especially in Colorado, like he was saying earlier, the environment is constantly changing, especially during the summer. And, you know, in the morning, you'll get a really, really pretty sunrise and it'll be semi, you know, sunny and beautiful. And then all of a sudden, all these storms will come in. And then once that, you know, clears, it's sunny again. But then you have the humidity factor as well. So you get a little bit of haze. So like he said, you just kind of got to be prepared for all the many different bipolar environments that Colorado will come out with.
So I wanted to move on a little bit to social media and the questions that we had, or that Amy had. You guys addressed perfectly in what's now a YouTube video, right? You just released it on YouTube. Was that today or no? Recently, I guess.
It was a 2-hour video. So I think it took like a day and a half to actually upload.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's okay. So the topics that I wanted to talk about on social media are addressed in that YouTube video. And since we're just over an hour right now, I actually just want to direct people over to that because there's a lot of really good information in there from how to build a platform, Well, I don't know. Can you summarize it really quick in a couple of minutes, kind of what's in that video? And then I'll link it into the show notes, and all of that stuff will be linked in there so that they can jump over and watch that video.
Yeah, that'll be great. So, I mean, the first thing is it's unfortunately an uncut video. We basically set up our main wildlife, camera up on a tripod and are taking a picture of us addressing the live on Instagram on our phone. So it's not like we're looking into the camera. It's not really production video, but all the information's there. And what we really went into was, if you want to start off, how do you build a brand, or what are the things that you need to think about before you really get started? Then we started jumping into, we actually brought up for the first time, hashtag magic sauce. And that was, strategy for posting. And that includes tagging accounts and hashtags, the proper mix of photos and videos and that sort of thing. And then kind of, identified how that works for both Instagram and Facebook. And then we talked about other ways that you can grow yourself as a brand. Talked about, what is your message? What are you trying to convey? What audience are you looking to reach? And keep that as a central focus of what you're doing. And then what we said was, not the secret, so the special sauce. So the special sauce was actually engaging your audience. And so magic sauce was, how you post, and the special sauce was how you engage your audience. And we talked about things like, commenting, searching through hashtags and commenting on when people post things that are of interest to you. Obviously, we're huge into elk, so we're looking at hashtag elk hunting. We see a big, somebody harvested a big bull, we'll put a comment on there congratulating them. If we see something that, sparks our interest, we'll ask them a question about it. And it creates a dialogue back and forth. And that creates an engagement that you don't get by just posting, and then having no follow-up with your audience. So, we try to put ourselves out there. We try to suggest that others do as well. And we actually got some really great feedback from one of the folks who sat in on the Instagram Live, who said that after they listened to the Instagram Live, they did a post, and they saw their first post after listening to it had five times more impact than, I think it was five times more likes than any post they had ever posted previously.
Holy cow. That's pretty impressive. So I noticed that same thing too. After you guys did the video, I pushed it out, and everybody, so I had a bunch of buddies and stuff that were in there watching that video too. And I noticed the next day on a lot of their posts where they had more hashtags, and they were immediately commenting on other people's posts. And I just saw them using the magic sauce and the special sauce. I saw them putting that to work, and I'm kind of curious to see over time what the increase on their following is. And I wanted to ask you too, and this is just very curious on my part, is there an actual hashtag magic sauce and secret sauce?
I think there is. I think I looked at it, and I think magic sauce has like 1200 tags on it, so yeah. It's not very much. I mean, it's definitely not a catchphrase that we expected to take off. I just kind of set it off the cuff, but I guess
that's how it happens, right?
Yeah, that's how those things kind of take off and get a life of their own. It definitely caused a stir on the Instagram Live, and I think we've kind of been keeping it going. I think we'll probably keep that as a running joke at Good Bull from now on.
Yeah. Well, I think you should. So jump over there and check that out on YouTube. It's linked in the description on the podcast description. So if you want to listen to that, or you want to check out how Good Bull built themselves, you started out 2017, and now you're up to, on Instagram alone, you're at 25,000 ish followers. So
should hit 24,000 tomorrow.
24,000 tomorrow. So in a year and a half, we'll say 24,000 followers. Now there's, I think you guys are doing the right thing, right? By the hashtags, and you've done it right, but you guys also have the work to back it up. Like, I could be doing hashtags and I could be doing secret sauce. I don't have killer pictures. I just have me. And like earlier, I posted a picture of me and my dog getting ready for a podcast, So I think that has a lot to do with it, but we're going to get a better camera and we're going to start doing better pictures too. So anyway,
well, you actually mentioned there something that I think is kind of important for a lot of accounts that are starting as well. And I did address in the Instagram Live was something called UGC or user generated content. There's a really symbiotic relationship between people who are creating content and those who are using content to help grow their page. And, you know, we strongly encourage people on social media to share our photographs and our video with credit to Goodwill Outdoors. We've even gone so far with some of the bigger accounts that share our stuff regularly of, you know, DMing them photos anytime they ask, or setting up a Dropbox and sending them photos that they can use because they do credit us. And obviously, you know, we're generating the content. We do own the copyright. We have the ability to, you know, say when people can and can't use it. But as a general rule for social media, we are allowing people to use our content with link credit, and that helps us grow, but also those great photos helps accounts that are not generating their own content and helps them grow.
Yeah, well, I think that's great. I'm gonna start stealing some of your pictures.
Please
yeah.
do.
Yeah,
not stealing, of course. I'll give credit where credit is due, but I'm gonna borrow some pictures. Actually, I think I've done that in the past. You guys posted one that I thought was really awesome, and it had to do with getting ready for elk season or missing I think it had to do with missing elk season, right? It was a picture of a gigantic bull, and I took that picture and I reposted it using the repost app. And I want to say that was one of my most liked pictures that I've ever had on my Instagram page. So I don't remember how many likes it had, but it was up there. So, so when we did the podcast with Amy, you mentioned something about how you prefer to see your pictures reposted. And can you touch on that? Or was that in the YouTube video?
I think that was in the YouTube video, yeah. Okay. So, I mean, obviously the repost app, it puts that big block in one of the corners that says what account it came from. And obviously they're doing that for copyright reasons, but, you know, the folks that are sharing our stuff, we want them to have the best image possible. So we actually recommend that people screenshot the image and then crop out anything that isn't part of the image and then save that and repost that. So they're not getting that repost app block of text that's got our you know, at Goodwill Outdoors on it. It's a pretty long name, and so it takes up a lot of the photo and can actually detract from from how good the photo is itself. So if you actually take a screenshot with your phone, you'll end up with a better image that'll be posted up online. And then, of course, you just, you know, you tag us and you put in, you know, photo credit at Goodwill Outdoors in the social account. And it's going to look a lot better than if you'd use one of the repost apps.
Yeah, perfect. So you mentioned the Goodwill Outdoors name. It's a long name.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. Where did you guys come up with the name Goodwill Outdoors?
So I'll take this one.
I thought you might.
For two different reasons. One, obviously, bull referring to bull elk. Elk is one of our most favorited wildlife to
subjects.
Yeah, wildlife subjects to photograph. But the other concept of the name actually comes from where I went to school. I am an Aggie, Texas A&M, and we have amongst our several exuberant amounts of traditions, one of them is anytime your fellow Aggie is doing something really nice or generous or humanitarian, something as small as simple as opening a door for somebody, you call them a good bull. And it can go, you know, several different ways to have different types of outreach, within the community and within your family. So, that's kind of on the other aspect of how this name became so important to us as well.
Yeah. I mean, when we started Goodwill Outdoors, you know, we kind of asked ourselves, why do we want to do this? Is it just about the photos? And really what we came down to when we wanted to get this thing up and going was, we wanted to meet people in the industry. We wanted to meet people in the outdoors that are, you know, the folks that are out there and, you know, that are hunting and fishing and camping and, you know, supporting conservation and, you know, all these things that we believe very strongly in, and all these organizations that we support very strongly. We wanted to connect with all these different people. And so it really was more than just, hey, we've got these great photos, you know, come look and see what we have. We wanted to connect with people. We wanted to go, you know, take photographs with fellow photographers. We wanted to go hunting with fellow hunting enthusiasts. We wanted to, you know, work with backcountry hunters and anglers and Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and other groups like this to, you know, help conserve our wild land and our hunting heritage. And so, you know, the good bull aspect of it from the Aggie sense really comes out in that. And then obviously the good bull from, you know, big bull elk to, you know, bison to moose to, you know, everything else that we're taking pictures and videos of, it's definitely got the wildlife connotation as well.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha. So really quick off topic here. What do you guys have planned for the April 27th BHA thing? Are you guys part of that? Are you doing some kind of presentation or something?
We are. So we're kind of co-hosting with them. So Trained to Hunt is doing their Saturday night social in conjunction with a BHA pint night at Oscar Blues in Colorado Springs on the 27th. And what we're doing as part of that is we've been helping with some of the marketing material. We've been using some of our photos and developing some of the flyers for it. And we're also going to be doing a filming event. We're actually going to be filming the pint night down there and possibly even part of the Train to Hunt event and putting together probably a video afterwards. We're also going to be selling prints and maybe some other things at the pint night / Saturday night social. With 10% of the proceeds going back to BHA.
Oh, awesome. That is awesome. Okay, so last question I have for you guys before I let you off of here. Where do you guys see Good Bull Outdoors going in the next year, 2 years, maybe 3 years?
I definitely think that we are going to be gearing more towards an all-encompass type business as far as doing multiple shoots, not only through photography, but videography for different type of hunting opportunities. We would really love to be involved with filming and shooting different kind of hunts for either, you know, the Wounded Vets Association, BHA, Hunting for Sustainability, trying to do anything possible to really get the aspect of what hunting means to, you know, this person, all the way from their very first time hunting to the seasoned hunter. We really would love to be able to capture that, and we think that we're going to have some pretty good opportunity to do that. But not on top of that, we really want to be connected with more people within our industry. We're really trying to, you know, not only learn from them, but share, you know, our knowledge as well. You know, kind of get a whole media, you know, business going kind of around all those different aspects, getting more involved with trade shows, not only with, you know, our own photography and media that we have to offer, but, you know, meeting more awesome people and, also, you know, hopefully doing a sponsored, you know, video for or a short film for any sort of film festival is definitely, you know, a goal within the next, I'd say, 2 years. Also, we would, especially being inspired by you, we would love to be able to kind of do more of the podcast aspects as well. I think, am I missing anything?
I think, you know, probably creating, you know, really becoming a media company, I think, yeah, is really what we're looking to gear this towards. And I think you hit on just about all the points. I think maybe, you know, also having a multifaceted website where people can, you know, have a resource to go and learn. You know, we're doing right now these live Q&As. We just completed our second. We're gearing up for our third live Q&A on Instagram. And the reason that we're doing the Q&A format is that, you know, people have a lot of questions out there. We're strong proponents of, you know, getting new hunters out there, especially getting women out into the hunting environment. And so the more of these places that we can go to, you know, collect information from different people and put it out there for them to, you know, help get rid of some of the mystique around, well, you know, I've never hunted before. How do I start hunting? you know, I think those are all, you know, meaningful goals that we're looking to try to tackle in the next couple of years. You know, getting more people into hunting. Obviously, we're losing the recruitment battle on hunting. Women, I think, is one of the strongest points that we have in the industry. And the more women that we can get out there to start hunting, the better off we're going to be. We're going to get families hunting again. And if, you know, whatever part we can play in that, from telling great stories through film to answering questions, to, you know, just developing a love of wild animals through hunting and conservation and photography and videography, we want to put that out there and make that available to people to join the ranks of hunter.
I think that sounds like a heck of a 2 or 3 year plan goal. I need to get my butt in gear and make my plan, I guess. Well, first off, thanks for saying you were inspired by me. I don't know if you meant me in general, but podcasters all over, but
especially you.
Well, thank you very much then. I'm willing to help you guys in any way that you want whenever you're going to try to kick that off. I think it's a budding industry right now, although it seems like everybody has one. A lot of them fall off after 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 shows, and there's only a few that kind of keep with it. So I'll help you any way I can when it comes to that. And I said that was my last question, but it wasn't. I lied. If somebody wanted to buy any of your prints or anything like that, how could they do that?
Well, for starters, I guess they could come to the pint night down in Colorado Springs on the 27th.
They're buying your plane tickets now. Come on.
Yeah. take the red eye, get out there, you know, get yourself a beer, you know, support conservation. We're going to have a bunch of prints for sale down there, but, you know, if anybody's scrolling through our Instagram or Facebook, they can send us a message, either email, private message on Facebook, DM on Instagram, reach out to us. We're developing a price list right now. We're going to be, developing a website, hopefully sooner rather than later, where people can go online and purchase them directly through there. But we don't have that set up yet. So in the meantime, just go ahead and message us. We'll be able to tell you based on size and material, be it canvas, paper, metal, etc., what the cost would be.
And all of throughout our whole social media platform, we're at Good Bull Outdoors.
Yep.
So it's pretty easy to find, I think.
So YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and we also have a Patreon page set up. So patreon.com/Good Bull Outdoors. That's a place set up where people can support the work that we're doing, both on the filming and the photography side. It's just basically a means of people saying, hey, you know, we love the content that you're doing. And, you know, like we were talking about before we really started getting recording here, you know, we're not really making money at this. We're just, for the most part, hoping to offset gas money and equipment money. And, you know, we've got a lot of money and equipment, and the more people that can support us out there, either on Patreon or by buying prints. And we also sell digital prints as well. So the more that people are willing to support us towards that effort, the more we can do, and the more we can engage people, and the more we can, you know, make that magic sauce for Good Bull Outdoors and you know,
hashtag
and get it out there.
Yeah, good. Well, all right. Thank you. That was going to be my final question, was contact info. All right. Well, thank you guys very much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And there's a ton of good information there. Don't forget, check the description down below for additional links. I'm going to put links to Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and then that one particular YouTube video. I'll link all that stuff down there in the description.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. We appreciate you having us on, and we appreciate Amy for her questions as well. And we feel very fortunate to, you know, be a part of this and be a part of what you're doing. Thank you all so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll tell you that this is actually the first podcast that we've recorded. So
yeah,
you get the honor of being number one.
Well, good, good, good. Well, I hope you guys get the opportunity to do a whole bunch more. There's so much information out there, and you guys have so much to tell people that I think, I don't know. I hope you get the chance to talk across the whole, I don't know how many podcasts there is, but there's only one, right? There's only one podcast in backcountry release.
There is, yeah.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thank you very much.
So again, I wanted to say thanks to Lauren and Allie for coming on the show. That was a lot of fun. They're such cool people and so down to earth and easy to talk to. After that show was over, we actually ended up talking for, I want to say, almost 2 more hours, just talking about all kinds of stuff, different hunts and conservation and backcountry hunters and anglers and just a good long just chat. So it was really cool to talk to them. So thanks again for coming on. And I wanted to say thanks to Dan at Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network for having me on the show. And normally I give you a kind of a heads up on who's coming up next. So I'm kind of sorting out what's coming up. We got a lot going on in the near future here. I'm shooting Total Archery Challenge. We've got a bear hunt coming up. I've got a lot of giveaway stuff that I want to announce and talk about, and some other administrative type stuff that I want to talk about. So we'll see what the next show is. Might be me just coming on and doing a quick 30-minute show about what's coming up. Could be something from Total Archery Challenge. Could be something bear hunt related. I'll keep you guessing. Come back next week and find out what we got. Thanks for listening, and I really appreciate it. Don't forget, check out backcountryrookies.com and at backcountryrookies on Instagram and backcountryrookies on Facebook. And then, of course, check out the group that we're building over on Facebook, which is Backcountry Rookies Nation. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I'm out of here.